Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. We welcome our radio and online audiences and our audience here at the Blue Room at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And it is my great pleasure tonight to introduce Steven Greenblatt, the author of The Swerve, an excellent book. I would say even one of the excerpts makes it worthwhile. An excerpt from Giordano Bruno, a philosopher, trying to explain his argument of why, in great detail, divine providence is probably an inaccurate idea. And he was a Dominican monk. So you get a little idea of the time. I just think this book is great for on so many different fronts. One, summarizing the ideas. If you're familiar with them, it still makes it perfectly clear what happened. It's a great look back into Lucretius's time, the time of the Roman Republic. It's a great look into the papal bureaucracy in the 1430s, which the person who found the book by Lucretius worked for as the papal secretary. And, you know, I know it's the papal bureaucracy, but it sounds like every bureaucracy that has ever existed on this planet, and there have been plenty. And it's also a great look into the Renaissance humanists and what drove them and what, in all their multiplicity, all their different angles that they had on it. It's just a wonderful look into all those areas at once. Stephen Greenblatt, a professor at Harvard in American and English Literature and the author of The Swerve and also Will in the World, the books on Shakespeare, and many, many other books. I think plenty of you have heard him speak before. Thank you very much. Stephen.
Thank you, George, and thank you all very much for being here. It's supposed to be the case that you can't go home again, but I think of the Bay Area as my home, having lived here in the past for more than a quarter of a century, and I'm back with enormous pleasure and had a sweet day, a wonderful lunch with dear friends, and a feeling of return that gives me pleasure. And since pleasure is supposed to be the highest value in life, according to the philosopher I'm interested in then you have given me indeed something enormously important today. I wanted to write a book about an amazing story, a story of a discovery of a lost manuscript that changed the world, but it was a slightly difficult thing to write from a purely narrative point of view because for many of my readers, I knew that there would be lots of uncharted territories. Indeed, there was uncharted territory for me. If you write a book about the life of Shakespeare, you can assume that everyone will have heard of Shakespeare, and everyone will have some sense that there's a reason to pester yourself with such a life. If you're writing a book about Poggio Bracciolini of Terra Nuova near Arezzo, you have much less of a sense that everyone will get it. People from Terra Nuova now renamed their town Terra Nuova Bracciolini. But otherwise, outside the immediate orbit of this little, rather, one of the only unattractive Tuscan towns, I think, you wouldn't know who their favorite son was. You might wind up in Terra Nuova where there's a little statue of Poggio, not a particularly attractive one, in the main square, but you wouldn't normally get there unless you had become lost on your way to the Armani outlet, which is on the other side of the highway. In any case, I had to somehow convey who this was, and not simply who this was, but why he was up to what he was up to and why one would care about it. And I'm not planning to read you very much at all from the book. You can, and I hope you will, some of you read it for yourselves, but I'll read you a tiny piece of it, partly to give you a flavor of the book and partly to give you a sense of how I tried to conjure up this figure from 600 years ago, doing something that is at once very peculiar, even more peculiar in his own time, and yet strangely compelling. What I do at the beginning of the book is simply conjure up a moment, January 1417, in which this rather modest-looking fellow was riding on the roads in the south, probably, of Germany, and of what people, as he was riding by on the roads, would have tried to make of him in a world in which there were a certain amount of traffic on the streets, but this figure didn't quite fit any of the categories. Who was Poggio then, I write? Why did he not proclaim his identity on his back? the way decent folk were accustomed to do. He wore no insignia and carried no bundles of merchandise. He had the self-assured air of someone accustomed to the society of the great, but he himself was evidently a figure of no great consequence. Everyone knew what such an important person looked like, for this was a society of retainers and armed guards and liveried servants. The stranger, simply attired, rode in the company of a single companion. When they paused at inns, the companion, who appeared to be an assistant or servant, did the ordering. When the master spoke, it became clear that he knew little or no German and that his native language was Italian. Poggio, by the way, had lived in Germany already for about 3 years, but seemed unbelievably allergic to learning German. If he had tried to explain to an inquisitive person what he was up to, the mystery of his identity would only have deepened. In a culture with very limited literacy, to be interested in books was already an oddity. And how could Poggio have accounted for the still odder nature of his particular interests? He was not in search of books of hours or missals or hymnals, whose exquisite illuminations and splendid bindings made manifest their value, even to the illiterate. These books, some of them jewel-encrusted and edged with gold, were often locked in special boxes or chained to lecterns and shelves so that light-fingered readers could not make off with them. But they held no special appeal for Poggio, nor was he drawn to the theological, medical, or legal tomes that were the prestigious tools of the professional elites. Such books had a power to impress and intimidate even those who could not read them. They had a social magic of a kind associated for the most part with unpleasant events, a lawsuit, a painful swelling in the groin, an accusation of witchcraft or heresy. An ordinary person would have grasped that volumes of this kind had teeth and claws, and hence have understood why a clever person might hunt them. But here again, Poggio's indifference was baffling. The stranger was going to a monastery, but he was not a priest or a theologian or an inquisitor, and he was not looking for prayer books. He was after old manuscripts, many of them moldy, worm-eaten, and all but indecipherable, even to the best-trained readers. If the sheets of parchment on which such books were written were still intact, they had a certain cash value, since they could be carefully scraped clean with knives, smoothed with talcum powder, and written over anew. But Poggio was not in the parchment buying business, and he actually loathed those who scratched off the old letters. He wanted to see what was written on the parchments, even if the writing was crabbed and difficult, and he was most interested in manuscripts that were 400 or 500 years old, going back then to the 10th century or even earlier. To all but a handful of people in Germany, this was in 1417, remember, this quest, had Poggio tried to articulate it, would have seemed weird. And it would have seemed weirder still if Poggio had gone on to explain that he was not, in fact, at all interested in what was written 400 or 500 years ago. He despised that time and regarded it as a sink of superstition and ignorance. What he really hoped to find were words that had nothing to do with the moment in which they were written down on the old parchments. Words that were, in the best possible case, uncontaminated by the mental universe of the lowly scribe who copied them. That scribe, Poggio hoped, was dutifully and accurately copying a still older parchment, one made by yet another scribe, whose humble life was equally of no particular consequence to the book hunter, except insofar as it left behind this trace. If the nearly miraculous run of good fortune held, the earlier manuscript, long vanished into dust, was in turn a faithful copy of a more ancient manuscript, and that manuscript a copy of yet another. Now, at last, for Poggio, the quarry became exciting, and the hunter's heart in his breast beat faster. The trail was leading him back to Rome, not the contemporary Rome of the corrupt papal court with its intrigues, political debility, and periodic outbreaks of bubonic plague, but the Rome of the Forum and the Senate House and a Latin language whose crystalline beauty filled him with wonder and the longing for a lost world. And that was what the man I'm interested in was, one of these peculiar figures of the 14th, the late 14th and 15th century, figures who already began to call themselves humanists and who shared a particular strange passion, the passion for finding the traces of the ancient past. The traces of the ancient past were all around anyone who lived in ancient Rome, anyone who lived in medieval Rome, rather, just as they were all around anyone who lives in Rome or anywhere else in Italy now. You could just look around and see them. And people had, for centuries before Poggio's time, not only been perfectly aware of the fact that there was once a civilization that left its marks in a very extravagant way all around the land, but they used those remains quite cheerfully, as they continued to do for a very long time after Poggio's lifetime. They used them in the way that you and I, anyone who goes to Italy now, can see for ourselves. That is to say, most of the medieval and Renaissance buildings of Rome, the churches and palaces of Rome, are covered with marbles that were pulled off the ancient Roman buildings. That's why they look the way they look. And for that matter, people in Poggio's Italy, also for centuries before and also for a very long time afterwards, knew that there were many statues in Rome. They were very good statues because, and very useful because they could be burned, melted down, and made into lime that was very good for connecting the stones in pigsties and in outhouses and so forth and so on. So there was a fungible value to the remnants of the ancient classical past. But something happened, something very peculiar happened in the 14th century and 15th century, that excited at least a small number of people in something other than the cash value of the stones they could pull off the ancient buildings. And that was the part of the world that Poggio was excited by. But it wasn't enough to do this for a living. There was no way to do this kind of thing for a living. Poggio Barcellini was a poor man's son. His father actually had to flee from the small town near Arezzo to get away from his creditors. He himself, as a boy, came to Rome as a late teenager with, as he put it, 5 pennies in his pocket, no fancy connections, and no clear idea of what he was going to do for a living, though he had already acquired some education. But he had something already in the 1390s that made him special. He had unbelievably beautiful handwriting. And weirdly enough, that odd possession, which outside of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance has never been actually all that clear a route to a great career, that turned out for Poggio to be a fantastic asset. It was an asset because this was a world, of course, of copying. Everything that was done in copies. Handwriting of this order of clarity was a gift. And it wasn't simply an order of clarity, it was a quality of graphic design, as we would fancily say, that no one really had seen in this form before. Poggio effectively invented, when he was a very young man, what we think of as the most beautiful script still, the clearest, most elegant script possible, that is to say, Roman, what became Roman typeface, what we call Roman typeface, and italics, for that matter. This is no small invention, though it wasn't seen in quite these terms at the time. But it brought him to the attention of the Chancellor of Florence, a very remarkable, then rather elderly man, who was interested in young men with special gifts. And it was this Chancellor of Florence who probably helped Poggio complete his education and who launched him in his career. The career was not as this older man, the Chancellor of Florence, might have hoped. The career was not in the service of the Florentine government, Florence being in a very exuberant and ambitious state of its life in the late 14th, early 15th century. But rather, what Poggio wanted and what his mentor helped him to get with a fancy letter of recommendation was the job. Imagine the, was it the 1980s when the job at Goldman Sachs or Lehman Brothers seemed like the thing everyone wanted, or McKinsey? If you were ambitious, if you were poor to begin with, if you saw the main chance, he got him the job that an ambitious young man would most have wanted in the papal court in Rome. The job was called apostolic scriptor. It was a job for someone with very good handwriting, which Poggio had, to copy documents in the papal court. And it was a chance to make a considerable amount of money and have a very cushy position at the center of both the symbolic and, to some extent, real center of power in central Italy, in Rome. And Poggio, in fact, wound up spending close to 50 years over a long lifetime working for a succession of popes in Rome, beginning as papal secretary. And there the story might have ended with a young man, ambitious, probably with not, how should we say, extravagantly fine-tuned moral character, but with a desire to get along in the world, living his life. He could have made a great deal of money if he had taken holy orders, if he'd become a priest, but he said he didn't have the vocation for it. He had a mistress. He had 14 children with her. That itself wouldn't have kept him from being a priest, of course. That was not all that unusual at the time. But he said he didn't have the desire or the vocation for it, so he remained a layman, working in the papal court and working away and slowly rising in their hierarchy. Until in the moment that my story is interested in, he had risen to what was the highest position that someone of his kind could aspire to. And that was not apostolic scriptor, the copier of documents and picker up of occasional fancy tips from people who wanted an in or wanted documents in the papal court, but what was called apostolic secretary. And secretary had its meaning of the kind it has now, but it also has the meaning it also has now. If you have a secretary, secretary has the word secret in it. It means you are in on the secrets, in the close to the center of the world of papal power. And in the early 15th century, when Poggio rose to this position, the pope he worked for had a lot of secrets. In fact, Poggio worked at that point for someone who probably was the worst pope in the history of the papacy, which is a quite impressive distinction if you know anything about the long history of that remarkable institution. This was a man named Bartolomeo Cossa, who came from the island of Procida near Naples, where his family had for a very long time quite successfully practiced piracy. Bartolomeo Cossa, being a restless and ambitious young man, decided to take it to the next level and became a lawyer. From his legal studies, which he pursued very, very successfully, he went on to take even the next step and enter the church, where he continued, as it were, the family business, but in a much more refined and in many ways much more lucrative way, rising in the clerical hierarchy of the late 14th century through a succession of positions until finally attracting a certain amount of fear and sinister attention until finally one day he was the Bishop of Bologna. He was visited by the Pope himself. Very shortly afterwards, virtually immediately afterwards, the Pope sickened mysteriously and died. Bartolomeo Cossa, who had been playing his cards for this moment, was elected Pope and promptly called himself John the 23rd. Now, he ruled as John the 23rd for a reasonable number of years until the events happened that I'll briefly tell you on the way to what I'm really going to tell you about. But I just need to say that if you recognize that name, John the 23rd, as I hope some of you do, it refers for people of my generation to a remarkable man who was one of the heroes of my childhood, Angelo Roncalli, the Neapolitan cardinal who called himself John the 23rd in 1958 and launched Vatican II. And did quite remarkable things in his short papacy. But the reason he called himself John the 23rd, as you know, there aren't multiple popes normally by the same name, is that in the early 15th century, in about 1415, the cardinals of the church, in a set of events that are beyond belief, but I will not tell you about tonight, decided, in effect, to take, we would say, take the pope's jersey away, remove him from his position, remove that name from him, and no one for 600 years, in effect, almost 600 years, dared to touch that name until Angelo Roncalli came along in 1958 and decided to return it to respectability. And not only respectability, but in his case, to greatness, at least in my humble view. In any case, this name was poisoned because of Poggio Bracciolini's boss, who was thrown into a dungeon by the cardinals who had finally said enough is enough, and who embarked by himself, because he was stripped of his secretaries and attendants, embarked on an exceedingly long process of plea bargaining that ended with the former pope confessing to a very long list of charges, including murder, heresy, simony, and so forth, and so incest, I think, provided that they suppress the 16 worst charges against him, which have never been revealed. Cannibalism, maybe? It's very hard to guess what they could have had against him, given what he's confessed to. In any case, our man, Poggio, was out of work. The Pope was not allowed to see his secretaries. He had nothing to do. He could have scrambled and quickly tried to find another job, but for reasons we don't completely understand, he didn't. And instead, what he did was to indulge what, as I said at the beginning, was a lifelong passion, book hunting. And one day in January 1417, he had a very, very, very good afternoon in a monastery somewhere in Germany, whose name he didn't reveal, probably because was in competition with other book hunters, and he wanted to go back to that grubstake that he had found, hoped someday he'd get back there. And he found a succession of remarkable things that afternoon. But the thing that is of the deepest concern to me, and the thing that is the subject of my book, is that on that day in January 1417, he found an ancient poem by someone whose name he would have recognized, because what the book hunters did was to try to memorize the names of writers whose works hadn't been seen for centuries and centuries. And this name was mentioned in the ancient texts by, in this case, the poet Ovid. The poet Ovid said, as long as the world exists, the verses of the sublime Lucretius will survive. But the verses of the sublime Lucretius had not been seen in public for 1,000 years and were presumed vanished forever. But that day in 1417, Poggio found the complete copy of a very long poem by the ancient writer Titus Lucretius Carus, who lived in the first century before the Common Era, and he decided to have the poem copied and to recirculate it in the world. Why was that important? Why was that a special day, not simply for Poggio, but for us? Because that poem was the sole, full, surviving representation, articulation of a whole school of ancient philosophy that had in effect been lost. Some of Plato had survived the Middle Ages. Some of Aristotle had survived the Middle Ages. The ancients knew about them, and the medieval intellectuals knew about Plato and Aristotle, but they didn't, in effect, know in any serious way what the philosophy known as Epicureanism or atomism was about. And here, very briefly before I stop, is roughly what the work that Poggio found in 1417 said. It said that the world consisted of an infinite number of invisible particles, a limited number of types of those particles, but an infinite number of them on the whole, that had existed forever. And the Greeks called those particles atoms, the things that can't be broken apart. Poggio called them the seeds of things. I'm not Poggio, Lucretius called them the seeds of things. And he said, Lucretius said, there are these atoms, and there's emptiness, the void, and nothing else. No mysterious other demons, no angels, nothing moving the things around in the world. And there never had been any force moving them around in the world. They existed forever. And when things exist forever that are in movement, they bang into each other. Sometimes they bang and repel each other. Sometimes they bang into each other and connect. And though it seems unbelievable, over enough time, and enough of these encounters of the atoms, things begin to form. Some things begin to form and last for a while. Some things last only very briefly. But the universe has, and everything that's in it, exists, Lucretius argued, because of the random banging together and coming apart of atoms over an infinite period of time without any creator, without any intelligent design, without any purpose, but in an enormous eternal dance of material particles. And that includes us. The world was not created for human beings. The world wasn't created for the Earth to exist. The universe exists and everything in it because of this extraordinary conjunction of the atoms. We are part of this process, as everything else in the world is, as this table is, as the Earth is, as the sky is and the sun. We're made of the same stuff that everything else is made of in different combinations. Our soul is also made of atoms. When our bodies die, our souls will die as well. That means that there is no afterlife, no punishment and reward. Whatever meaning there is, ethical or otherwise, in the world for us is here and now, in this world. And that meaning, Lucretius argued, should begin and end with what all sentient creatures dream about, long for, and go toward, is pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And any system that we come up with has to be about that. And therefore, Lucretius thought the religions of the world were largely delusional and cruel because they're about suffering and discipline rather than about the pursuit of pleasure. The highest goal of life is pleasure, and the universe is, for human beings, or should be, the experience not of piety or virtue or glory or ambition, but the pursuit of pleasure and the experience of wonder. Wonder that, strangely enough, you exist, we exist for the time that we're here, and we won't exist forever. This was, and much more, was what Poggio pulled out of a library in 1417. And I think that you will immediately see two things about this, and there's much more to say about it. One is that in certain ways, and in ways I haven't fully described yet, this anticipates in an eerie way lots of thoughts that would come to people centuries and centuries afterwards. There's a part of Lucretius that is very much about creatures coming into being and then disappearing, other species on the earth existing before we did, other species coming to exist after we live, because everything is constantly rolling over and turning over. There's, in other words, an anticipation of Darwin. There's an anticipation of Einstein. There's an anticipation of Freud. It's a quite astonishing, in effect, core of much of what passes for modernity. And it's also, of course, a laundry list of the kinds of things the Inquisition was looking for in people in the 15th and 16th century. So part of my story is what happens when a spaceship comes down, because this was not material that had somehow survived the Middle Ages, but had been out of circulation for 1,000 years, comes down and lands in 1417 with this message, and how we get from that to the peculiar place we're in now, a place in which, as you know, no American politician, Democrat or Republican, could run on quite this list of principles and hope to be elected. But I will stop here, thanking you for listening to me and turning it over to you, and very much eager to hear your questions and comments and to respond to them. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our radio and audience online that we are listening to Stephen Greenblatt's talk at the Commonwealth Club of California on his book, The Swerve, about the rediscovery of Lucretius's book on the nature of things. It's time for questions and answers. Who has the first question? Anybody has another question? Go up to the mic.
Where did you get the name The Swerve?
Ah, The Swerve has multiple meanings for me. Thank you very much. It starts here. the ancient atomists, the people who thought about this question of the world being made up out of atoms, they began by thinking, if you drop things, they fall in a straight line. So why, if there are atoms, if everything is made up out of these little infinitesimally small particles, why does anything happen? Why doesn't everything just drop in a straight line? And the answer, Lucretius says, is that because there is in all matter, in each atom, a infinitesimally small is all that has to be swerve. And it's not a straight line, a swerve. And this was an idea that was, among other things, regarded as particularly ridiculous in Lucretius's physics, really until quantum physics came toward the end of the 20th century and began to think, yes, there is actually movement in the atoms. Lucretius and Epicurus before him got the idea by looking at shafts of sunlight and looking at those dust motes in the sunlight and thinking about the ways in which the dust motes move constantly. So first meaning is simply that question. But the reason that the question of why anything exists, the second thing that is in that word, the swerve, is that for Lucretius and for the Epicureans, that's why also there's free will. They said, why isn't the case that once you discover that the universe is just made up out of material and emptiness, why isn't everything determined by its position in a set of material relations, atomic relations? Why isn't everything absolutely fated to be exactly as it is? And the answer is for this very peculiar principle of randomness, of accident, of swerve that's built into all matter. And then the third thing, for my purposes, is that I'm fascinated by why it is that cultures, for good and ill, often for ill as well as good, but in any case, why they don't march in straight lines. Why isn't everything, as it were, like ancient Egypt was for a very long time, basically this what looks like the same thing generation after generation? What causes a whole culture to turn in a different direction? That is, of course, to some extent, the quintessential problem of the Renaissance, or for that matter, subsequently of modernity. How do things turn in a direction away from where we think they're going? As I say, there are unhappy versions of that story as well as happy versions, but the story I'm telling is how a whole culture, starting from a single flap of a butterfly's wing, namely this man taking a book off a shelf, began to swerve in a different direction. Yeah.
Stephen, I can't help wondering about the environment in which Lucretius lived, and yet it had its own theology, its own dominant gods and beliefs and so forth. It sounds as if his views at that time were not much more popular than they would have been in the 14th, 15th century. So I'm wondering if you were able to find out anything about his life, what happened to him, how he was thought of in his own time. And if you can't answer that, maybe you could say something about Piero and what happened to him.
There's very little, it happens, that's known. There's a lot that's known about the discoverer, Poggio, but Poggio lived, compared to Lucretius, Poggio lived late last night. He lived until 1459. But in the case of Lucretius, we know almost nothing about him, and that's strange, because we know actually quite a lot about the sex life of Ovid or the political views of Virgil, but we know actually remarkably little about Lucretius. Now, that probably means not much more than the fact that he was shy or recessive, didn't want his name bandied about. But it's odd. And the only biographical information we have about him, apart from what you can gather simply through the reading between the lines of his work, which is very little about him personally, but the fact that he was a disciple of the Greek philosopher Epicurus, and so forth, but not very much of a personal kind, comes from much, much later, from the 4th century, late 4th century, when St. Jerome, 4th century of the Christian era, when St. Jerome, who was bringing up to date an old chronicle, said that Lucretius was born around 99 before the Common Era, that he was given a love filter by his wife. He went insane as a result of being given this love filter and this love potion. And then in the intervals when he briefly returned to sanity, he wrote his poem, and then committed suicide. Now, maybe this is true. It's hundreds of years later. It happens to be what good Christians like St. Jerome thought pagan philosophers probably had their lives like. I mean, that's what it was about. So there's no reason, as far as I can tell, to actually credit this story. As you know, if you read articles in the newspaper about people you know, most of the details are wrong anyway. And if you think 300 or 400 years later, with a very different culture, it's very unlikely that is to be trusted. But it happens that we know something more about the whole ambience of the first century before the Common Era, and it roughly goes like this. Lucretius was a contemporary of Julius Caesar, of Cicero, older contemporary, somewhat older than Virgil. That is to say, he's living in the late years of the Roman Republic. They were a very difficult time in which the politicians began to squabble and cease to agree with each other about anything. The economy was going to hell. No one believed that the situation could go on much longer the way it was. There was still an enormous amount of power in the Republic, but it was heading in a direction no one fully understood. People had ceased to believe, at least in large numbers, ordinary people might have, but the intellectuals had ceased to believe in the old stories about the old religious stories about Jove or Diana. They went through the motions of going to the temples and worshiping, but you can tell from reading Cicero and the like that they were very skeptical about it. And evidently, in this strange atmosphere, which is, of course, completely unfamiliar to us, a lot of people, thoughtful people, wondered what it was all about, felt that the old order wasn't holding, but couldn't figure out what the new order would be. And there were a series of, evidently in this period, a series of competing ideas about what it might be. There were ideas that were coming already from the Middle East about various mystery cults, the cult of Mithra and so forth, that would bring stories of sacrifice into the Roman world. There were Persian religions. There were, of course, the old pagan religions. There were always the stiff-necked Jews around. But you're absolutely right that this particular set of beliefs, the ones associated with Lucretius and Epicurus, could not possibly have been popular with people of a pious disposition, and evidently weren't. Something weird happened not so long ago, I mean, by comparison with this, which is in the 18th century of our era, the people digging around, actually farming around in the rich volcanic soil around the Bay of Naples, found strange things in the ground, including turning up some statues. And that caused a kind of gold rush, of statue rush around the Bay of Naples that led to the digging up of, first of all, and most famously, at Pompeii, and then the finding of the nearby town, which was like Sausalito or Bolinas of Herculaneum, maybe Sausalito, fancy, a beautiful town on the coast. And in the course of just basically, it wasn't archaeology really, it was more Indiana Jones smash and grab idea of trying to find statues. They broke into a room, a strange hollow room, underground at this point. They're way underground. And they found what looked like a pile of charcoal briquettes, which, since it was chilly, they brought up to the surface and they started to burn the charcoal briquettes. And it wasn't until someone dropped one of the briquettes that it broke open and they saw there was writing inside. And they realized they weren't briquettes. They were books in the form of scrolls that had been carbonized by the volcanic eruption in 79 AD when Mount Vesuvius went off. And though they destroyed a whole bunch more of them trying to open them up and read what was inside, eventually an exceedingly clever Jesuit figured out a way of unpeeling very, very slowly the outside of them. That still destroyed a bunch of the outside of it, but they began to read more and more of what was in the inside. And what they found, actually to their disappointment in the 18th century, was that they had found the library of a very wealthy person who was evidently a follower of the philosophy I'm talking about this evening. That is to say, a follower of the school of Epicurus, and who had collected a substantial library, philosophical library, about the meaning of the universe in relation to atoms and emptiness and nothing else. So that's the most startling glimpse we have of what kind of world this stuff could have come out of. The world of probably powerful, well-to-do, hard-bitten, probably tired and worried people in the late Roman Republic trying to figure out where things were going. Yes.
Thank you for your talk. I actually heard you speak this morning on NPR, and I want to first ask you a quick question. Are you an Epicurean yourself?
Well, in multiple senses, first of all, I like pleasure. But I don't like extravagant pleasure. I'm not a binge eater, a heavy drinker. Epicurus was not, despite his reputation. Oh, I confess I use the website Epicurious to find recipes occasionally. But the more extravagant things that were attributed to Epicureans, orgies, binge drinking, and so on and so on, are precisely not part of this tradition. Epicurus thought that he wasn't against them morally, but he thought that led to hangovers, bad feeling, the ends of relationships, and so forth and so on. So he thought that you should, you know, sort of basically keep it in moderation. So in that sense, I am. And I'm also in the sense that I don't myself believe that there is... I always look with wonder and some, I confess... I won't say cynical amusement, but some amusement when I see baseball players round the bases and look up to heaven as if the divine were worshiping, or the divine were watching what the Giants were doing that afternoon. I mean, that. So in that sense, I don't think there's someone out there who's probably determining what we're up to.
Well, my bigger question is in comparison of the philosophies of if you live that life of no ups and downs and try to keep it tranquil, then what about the passion? What about, you know, that if you don't experience pain, how can you experience great love?
Yes.
If you don't see destruction, how can you see beauty? How can you really, you know, art, poetry,
yes,
philosophy,
yes,
a lot of things come from,
yes,
pain. And, you know, what is the right way to live in order to...
Yes.
Not to survive better, I guess.
It's a wonderful question, and a question to which I don't have a suitable and certainly not a glib answer. It is certainly the case that that the inheritance of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, for that matter, have immensely complicated and in many ways enriched our inheritance, however wonderful and remarkable that inheritance from the ancient world is, and certainly complicated in relation to suffering. I mean, that is to say, the Epicureans would have been quite deeply baffled by a religion that had as its central symbol a battered, bleeding, and suffering divinity. They would have thought this was a truly incomprehensible idea, although they would have said, yes, that's what religions usually do. That's why we need, because actually, I mean that, because Lucretius, writing in 50 before the Common Era, so this has nothing to do with Christianity, says that the trouble with religions is that they always seem to come back to the idea of the sacrifice of children. He's thinking of the sacrifice of Iphigenia by Agamemnon, I think, but he finds that a kind of pregnant symbol of what is wrong with religious thinking. That said, and I think in a way fascinating about your question, is that passion, and particularly sexual passion, is a problem for these people. Because if your idea, they're not ascetics. They don't think, unlike early Christians, for example, or like many Jews from late antiquity, they don't think that some kind of restraint or renunciation... Jews were not as restrained that way as Christians. I mean, that is to say, Jews believed that you needed to generate offspring. But then, as you probably know, there are many ancient rabbinical responses trying to figure out what the minimal number of times you have to sleep with your wife is. But the Christians, of course, in some sense wanted to give this up entirely, hence monastic communities. But that's very much against the Epicurean or Lucretian view, because this is a world in which pleasure is at the center of the value of human existence, and they totally understood that sexual pleasure was, for most people, the height of their experience of pleasure. The reason it's a problem is that they also recognized that sexuality at its most intense is associated with pain as well as pleasure. And that caused them considerable perplexity. And the way in which Lucretius, I think Lucretius is a fantastically brilliant man and a wonderful poet, but the way in which Lucretius as a piece of advice tended to deal with it seems to me one of the most disappointing aspects of his work, which is he said, is to say, look, the real problem is to get fixated on a particular person, be obsessed with this person and suffer so much because of this person. The way to deal with it is take lots of lovers. Boys, girls, men, women, it doesn't matter. Many, many, many lovers, and that will reduce the fixation. But that's, I think, disappointing side of the man for reasons that your very eloquent question suggests. But I want to read you one tiny piece of something more interesting in Lucretius. The poet Yeats, W.B. Yeats, said that Lucretius wrote the most remarkable description of sexual intercourse ever written. And Yeats probably had read quite a few descriptions of sexual intercourse or could have thought of them himself. And it's because of this problem. It's because he was trying to think what is going on here. And this is from Lucretius. There's no great English translation of the whole of Lucretius, but there are wonderful partial translations of Lucretius' greatest hits by the 17th century poet John Dryden, who was very much in tune with what Lucretius is up to. This is from Dryden's translation of Lucretius on sex. When the youthful pair more closely join, when hands in hands they lock and thighs in thighs they twine, just in the raging foam of full desire, when both press on, both murmur, both expire, they grip, they squeeze, their humid tongues they dart, as each would force their way to the other's heart. In vain, they only cruise about the coast, for bodies cannot pierce, nor be in bodies lost, as sure they strive to be, when both engage in that tumultuous momentary rage. So tangled in the nets of love they lie, till man dissolves in that excess of joy. You see, he gets it. He gets there, as opposed to the cheap advice about having a lot of lovers. He gets both the intensity and the edge of pain. And he attributes the pain to the quality that many of us will recognize, in not only in sex, but in religion and lots of other aspects of life, the longing for something that just eludes you, the dream of getting there, but finding that you're limited and can't quite get there. And that is at the center, really, of the pastoral advice Lucretius was trying to give you. Try to live within your limits. Try to accept that you can't get all the way there.
One other part of your question, I think, that we've discussed before on these evenings about pain. I think a lot of people like to think of the great artists as suffering and the great writers as suffering. But, you know, a lot of people say, well, you have to suffer that greatly in order to be a great artist. But I think it's basically a creative mind's trying to lift themselves out of that suffering. Not that the suffering was the cause of the great creative act. So that's another element of it.
Thank you very much. Next question.
How is Lucretius's ideas different from, say, Eastern Buddhist thought? You know, Buddha's enlightenment was noticing all the particles floating in his body, and there's, you know, everything is constantly changing, and what do you see are the differences in those two forms of thought?
I should turn the question really back to you, because I don't know enough about Eastern thought, but I do from the very, very little I know. When I lived in Berkeley for all those years, I did a certain amount of sitting in and breathing in Zazen. I do recognize an affinity between between Epicureanism, between Lucretius, and the Buddhism that is interested in nothingness, the Buddhism that is determined to displace humans in their fantasies from the center of the universe and to return you to a sentient being, breath in, breath out, that links you to other creatures in the world, breath in, breath out. So whether there's any possible link of a historical kind, whether word could have reached first century Rome via the trade to the Far East, where there were certainly complicated relations through Persia, because we know that there are lots of, and there are trade routes. There's more mobility in the world than we think that there is. There are more things moving in the world than we think there is. We think there were very sharp boundaries. But the whole point of my project in this book, but in general, a larger vision perhaps of things, is that perfect stability and rootedness is not actually the cultural condition of mankind, except in the rarest of times. Most of the time, things are always moving about. So it's entirely possible that there was some peculiar actual historical interpenetration of ideas from the East and the philosophy that we're talking about here. Yes.
Hi. Gary, Malaysian. You just said a key word, movement. And I don't agree that you have to suffer pain to have pleasure. And I don't think that you can't get there without pain. Mm-hmm. I think that you can do those things. You just need to let go.
Oh, yes.
Too many people are hanging on to things instead of letting them go. And when you let go, you begin to move. And in that movement, you get intertwined with the universal energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with words and pain.
Yes.
I agree. And now, would you... There's a guy called Dionysus.
Mm-hmm.
Where does he fit in all this?
I think that in general, Lucretius, in his time and world, was probably skeptical of the cult of Dionysus, if that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Skeptical about what was called Sparagmos, the dream of being torn apart. I think he was a Roman. He believed, I think, in some greater order than that. I can't see him marching on the mountainsides with the thyrsus. But it's true that Lucretius begins this remarkable poem, and it's very important that it's a poem. It's an incredibly beautiful poem. He begins his poem with the greatest hymn to Venus ever written. It's very strange that it's a hymn. It's back to that earlier question about that involved the question of religious belief as well. This is someone who says that there's no point in praying to the gods. They can't do anything for you, and they're enjoying themselves in their own world. But this is a poem that begins with the greatest ancient hymn to the goddess Venus. It's Venus, really, rather than Dionysus. Venus, the goddess of love. He's imagining the whole world as in its happiest forms, even the atoms that make us what we are, or the table what it is, or the water what it is, as in a form of sexual conjunctions, a form of pleasure, excitement. And he's singing that hymn. And one of the most remarkable things that happened with this poem when it came back in 1417 is that the first people who got it were not the theologians or philosophers who tended to think it was crazy or perhaps crazy tinged with wicked, but it was the artists. And the most powerful image of what they got, really, is from, now it's too familiar to us perhaps because we've seen it reproduced too often, but Botticelli's Primavera and Birth of Venus, but particularly the Primavera, is directly influenced by the recovery of Lucretius's poem. Botticelli got it. And he got what was, in your terms, ecstatic about it and beautiful about it and satisfying about it without the strong element of blood and suffering.
Exactly.
So I think But he didn't think it was a world without blood and suffering. I have to say, this is a poem that ends, that begins with a hymn to Venus and ends with a horrific description of the plague in Athens, the bubonic plague in Athens. And the reason it ends that way is twofold. First of all, Lucretius wants to give you an explanation. He thinks that things that people normally attribute to the gods, such as plague, someone is throwing an arrow at you, are actually caused by natural forces. He says, I don't know what they are, but I think there are invisible things that are being passed that are making people sick in the sky. He has affect the intuition of germs, but he doesn't have a term for them. Obviously, this is long before experimental science. But he also wants to put it in because he says, effectively, the world has pain in it. The world has pain and suffering. The world has disease and misery. We're all going to die. We're all going to pass through terrible experiences of pain. We have to learn how to accept this and to accept our condition and to hold on to what pleasure we can in that condition.
The interesting thing is when you're in your mind, which most of us exist in our minds, you can't get to the universe. You have to be out of your mind to get to the universe.
Yeah.
And most of these things you're describing are words. And when you put down words on paper, you are in your mind. And you can't get to the universe being in your mind.
Uh-huh. Maybe St. Jerome was right that Lucretius was mad some of the time in this account and therefore came back from the madness to write down what he had experienced. Yes.
Yes. fabulous talk, by the way.
Thank you.
recently, I was reading some Albert Camus, and specifically The Stranger, and I got interested in what his philosophy was. He's usually connected with the existentialists, but according to himself, his philosophy was something he called absurdism.
Yes.
And so I said, well, that's an interesting name for a philosophy, and I just looked it up to see how it's defined. And the description of it was, it's the belief that man exists in a purposeless, chaotic universe. And in a way, that's sort of, it seems like an outgrowth of the idea of Epicurean, of the philosophy of Epicurus. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense to me that the tone and the emotions of Epicurus and of Lucretius are very different from those of Camus or Sartre. I mean, they're happier, if I can put it that way. They're much more, they're filled with wonder and not a sense of suffering or disillusionment, though they embrace suffering and disillusionment in the vision. But on the whole, the account is, yes, the universe doesn't have any meaning. The idea that the gods are doing X or Y to us, either for good or ill, is itself an illusion. We are what we are, and we are related to this process. We slowly emerge from chaos and destruction, and we construct whatever civilizations that we can. In that sense, they're very close, but without the sense of, I mean, Camus and Sartre come from however dark there are moments in Epicurus and Lucretius, the 20th century developed forms of pessimism that would have surprised these pessimistic ancients. And I think that on the whole, it goes back to what several of you have already said, Lucretius actually believed this was the good news. You don't have to be stoical about it. This is the good news. Now, contemporaries, even Cicero, Lucretius' contemporary, said, in effect, this is the good news? But Lucretius insisted, yes, this is the good news. The good news is that we have only ourselves and the world that we live in. We're part of the universe that we live in, that we're made of the same things that the stars and the trees and the dirt under our feet are made of, and that should fill us with wonder and pleasure. And that's different from the tone of The Stranger or of The Plague or of Sartre.
My name is Nicholas, and my question is, the little that I, not being a historian or a great writer or reader, the question that what I see of Rome, it wasn't whether you were homosexual or heterosexual, it was who wanted to play. There was that element of you wanted to pleasure each other. And that seems to be of their time. And as our time, it's like, who are you going to marry? Who are you going to go to the prom with? Who are you going to pair up with? So there's that whole social construct that is pushing towards relationship and mating and permanency for the society. The values of societies were different, as was their writing.
That's interesting. It's certainly true in terms of the sexual politics of this poem. Lucretius is totally indifferent to whether it's homosexual or heterosexual relations. I mean, that for him, that this is the idea that this would be a significant distinction would have struck him as extremely strange and inappropriate. It doesn't matter whether, as he says very explicitly, whether it's a beautiful girl or a beautiful boy. I mean, this is a matter of indifference to him. But I think it's the case that the world that he lived in was probably in its own way different from ours, a world with very, very powerful social categories, categories of focused on things like clientage, who you were a client of, who was your patron, categories of power and deference. And, of course, it was a world that had an enormous number of slaves. Different social structure, but one that would have been a distinct one. I can't resist telling you a strange thing that you can see for yourselves. If you're going to Rome sometime and you write ahead of time to the Vatican, you can get permission to go to the right directly under St. Peter's to the pagan burial site over which St. Peter's Cathedral was built. There's an enormous necropolis in whole streets of the dead with tombs in them that go right under St. Peter's. And if you can slow the guide down, who's very eager to show you where St. Peter might have been martyred, and just actually look at some of these pagan tombs, and if you can read Latin, there's an amazing one along the way that says, a Latin inscription that says, my name, I don't remember, my name was Faustus, I was married to Primitiva for, I can't remember the names any longer, for 25 happy years. We had a very lovely life. She made a very good house for me. I enjoyed my life. And when you, passerby, go home, make love to somebody and think of us. Now, that's probably a trace straight under the St. Peter's of this lost world of Epicureanism.
It's a great trace. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
Oh, I have the microphone. Thank you. I have, in no particular order, a couple of questions, one of which you just touched on. And the first one that I would really like to know is what led you down the path of Poggio? And if you just mentioned about in Italian, the scripts in Italian. If you have read the translations of Lucretius in Italian and in English or other languages, and if they might differ in some way, and if you were an Epicurean, what advice would you give to yourself or someone else if you could not achieve both pleasure/tranquility and absence from pain? If you had... if you could achieve the pleasure and tranquility but still had the pain, how would you address that issue?
Yes,
that's
no,
right,
I see.
I'll
take them in order, and you might, if I forget, you'll remind me. As far as Poggio goes, I was interested in, as they say, how things change, what happened. I was always interested in since my late teenage years when I first encountered Lucretius's poem, I've always been interested in this poem. I happened to pick it up by accident. I read it. No one assigned it to me. It wasn't organized, non-fun in school. I just happened to pick it up at a book sale and read it, and I was hooked. And so it's been in my head for my whole life. I found it incredibly moving and strange, and I always thought someday I'll work on it. But then I, completely unrelated to this, I became interested in the idea of how things recirculate after a long time when they're lost. What happens when things re-enter circulation? What does it mean when something is dormant and then starts moving again? And I began to read about Renaissance book hunting, and I kept – there are lots of different names of Renaissance book hunters, starting with Petrarch in the 15th century. But the name that kept coming back was this peculiar name, Poggio Bracciolini. He found a lot of things. He found Vitruvius's great book on architecture. He found Quintilian's great book on rhetoric. He just had an amazing run of remarkable discoveries. And it was then that I bumped up against the fact that he had found Lucretius's on the Nature of Things. So then I started to try to find out about him. Unfortunately, there's not a good biography of Poggio in English. There is a very good one in German by someone named Walser. So that's where I started, was to read Walser's biography and think about what this life was like. And it's a very complicated and rich and interesting life. So that's the first thing to say. About translations, I haven't read an Italian translation of Poggio. I've read a number of English translations of the Latin, and the translation that I would love to see that's lost now is not either English or Italian. Amazingly enough, this poem was translated by the French playwright Molière in the 17th century, but the translation's lost. So who knows, but that would have been a fantastic thing. But I've read both poetry and poetic and prose translations in English of the poem, and there are some aspects of all of these that I like quite a lot, but none of them is perfect. But about your third question, which is a difficult one, and if I understand you, the question was, what if someone experienced pain, wasn't able to banish or get rid of pain, but was, what would you give? What would I give such a person? How would I give it to myself or someone else? I'm probably not going to be able to answer this question at all adequately. I'll tell you what the ancients said about Epicurus. When Epicurus was dying in extreme pain of I think now we would say probably blocked urinary tract or something unspeakably unpleasant. He was suffering a lot, and people asked him how he was getting through it. And he said he was getting through it by remembering the extraordinary friendships that he had in his life, and that it was the friendships. He was apparently a man with a remarkable gift for friendship. It was the friendships and the thought of the friendships that he had that was enabling him to actually deal with relative tranquility with what most people would find unbearable. This is, of course, a world without morphine. So it's an odd answer. One doesn't normally think of a friendship as an antidote to suffering, but I take it seriously as something remarkable in this unusual philosopher's life and possibly something that one could both give to oneself and give to, since we're all going to have to deal with something of this kind, give to oneself and give to people that you love. It's an inadequate answer, I'm afraid, but it's the best one I can conjure up from this ancient world.
Way more than adequate. Just a few announcements. There are just 5 or 6 copies of the book still for sale out in front. If anyone would like to walk off with one. Another thing is that I think this is a great example of one of the things that Stephen talked about in his book, which is an author reaching out over time with his thoughts, and out of the blue, somehow you connect personally with that person over centuries of time and space. And I think it's very clear that you reached out to all of us and did the same thing right here and brought some people back to life for us very, very well. That's one thing. And the other thing, I think it's kind of ironic that on the day we celebrate Columbus's rediscovery of America, that we're talking about the rediscovery of Lucretius's thing. And that's the way to end another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion.